I have no further questions of this witness. Dean McKay?
Mr. Jackson, I'd like to ask you one or two questions, and perhaps other members of the commission would. You said this morning that during the various jobs that you held in the institution, you were ordinarily locked up 16 to 18 hours a day.
Yes, sir.
Did you work 5 days a week, or 6 days a week, or 7 days a week?
On all the jobs except the identification job, I worked 5 days. On the identification job, I worked 5 and a half. I'd work Saturday mornings. But the rest of them, it was usually 5 day jobs.
When you had a 5 day job, what was your experience with being locked up in your cell? How many hours a day in those circumstances?
16, 17 hours a day.
I asked the question the wrong way. On the days when you were not working.
Oh, then I would, if I wasn't, like the last job, I was working 5 days. If they held yard, I would go to the yard, but some days wouldn't have what they call coverage, you know, so they wouldn't hold any yard, so you'd have to stay in your cell, say, all morning. Then in the afternoon, they'd be sure and have yard. But if they had yard, I'd go on out and walk around. I used to jog, but they made them stop that after the uprising. It was no longer you can run, or they used to have weights in the yard, and they no longer have those. And the recreational facilities are really, there's a lot less now than we had before.
I wanted to ask a question or two about your parole also. If you had not found a job on your own, how long would you have stayed in the institution?
After you're over your date, 2 months after your possible release date, then the parole officer arranges for you to see a parole employment officer. And then he starts looking for a job for you. And then if you go 6 months over your date, you reappear at the parole board, and they just talk to you again. Usually they continue the date longer. I've seen men go over a year that had an open date, because I worked in the identification. I seen one man went over a year with an open date waiting to find a job.
What kind of jobs did they typically find for those who could not find jobs on their own?
Oh, like, I really can't say too well, but I know what a lot of men went out to. It was like a job like washing dishes or something like this. It's a minimum job. It's hard to get unless you were experienced in one particular field, it's hard to get a job that isn't just plain manual labor at a cheap rate.
What is your present job?
I work in a sheet metal factory at the present time.
If you wanted to change that job, would you have to have the consent of your parole officer?
Yes, sir.
What other conditions are, is your parole different in respect to conditions than others, or is yours typical?
Mine is a typical. Upon the your parole, they give you a list of parole conditions. I received this when I come home. It's the first time I've seen it, but it just tells you, you have to notify them of any change in job and residence and all this type of thing. And then no driver's license and the voting, you can't vote, and these things like this.
How often do you have to see your parole officer?
At the present time, I have write-in reports, and he comes to Jamestown. This is where I live, Jamestown, New York, and he comes there, and he will call you up, and then you go and meet him.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. I think we might take questions now, working right from one side of the commission to the other. Mr. Hanks?
I have actually three questions relative to some of the things you already answered. One of the things that I've noticed in the pictures that were shown of Attica in the yard, and as the camera moved throughout the penitentiary, the impression I got of the yard that it was huge, you know, and I think that any viewer who saw this picture would get this impression. Would you say that the yard is big enough to offer the type of recreations that would be necessary for a person to really recreate?
No, because if you have men out there playing football, which they used to have as a sport, nobody else could go on the field. It's small. And like the football team is 18 men, there's 500 men that are supposed to use this yard. And they're using the whole field. So the other 460 have to walk around the outside, the perimeter, because this is the only room that they do have.
I have two more questions. Another one is, I just want a little closer statistics. You said the majority of the guys have drops, you know,
droppers,
heat. I'm assuming, and which I know is a fact, that a guy gets things out of commissary, you know, and they taste better warm.
Certainly do.
Certain things, you know, even though they sell them, there's no way in order to heat them up. Like if you decide to buy certain things, that normal people would eat warm.
Right.
The only way you could do it is have a drop. Would you say, in percentage-wise, how of the men in the institution, you said the majority is, what
I would say,
you say?
75 to 85% would have one of these. Either this or a stove, one or the other.
Okay, and then the last question is, which I'm kind of confused on, is in reference to your sentence. You said you had 3 bags of marijuana.
Yes, sir.
And which you were giving away.
Yes, sir.
You wasn't sentenced to 7 years for selling marijuana?
Sale under New York State law is gift, bartering, or medium of exchange. A gift is the same thing as selling it.
Well, how do you feel in view of the fact now that the attitude about marijuana has changed radically and you still got 7 years?
I'm still doing the time. I'm still being punished for the same thing. And now they say, well, it isn't so bad, but this doesn't mitigate my sentence or anything. I can still... Actually, I could be violated tomorrow and go back and spend another 4.5 years there.
So would you would feel it was unjust?
Yes, I would.
Okay.
Mr. Jackson, I have just one question I wanted to ask. That's really for clarification. And it has to do with Mr. Oswald's taped discussion the week before the problem at Attica. And you say it was very disappointing, and I gather that's what we've heard elsewhere. But the thing I'm curious about is, was it, in fact, to your knowledge, had any correction commissioner ever before even appeared or spoken to the penitentiary in any fashion?
The prior correction commissioner, Mr. McGinnis, I believe he was in office something like 20 years, and he was completely away from the whole situation. And knowing how vocal Mr. Oswald was and how he had come on strong, much was expected of him. And this is why I think that the people really felt bad about it, that he didn't make a minor concession. If he had made one or two, I think that this could have been averted, really.
I just want to ask you, were you, while in prison, did you fraternize much with the black inmates?
Yes, I did. I worked with black inmates. Let me put it this way. I have come from a rural atmosphere. I didn't relate too much to black and Puerto Rican people. If nothing else, I learned that I can, you know, relate to them. And that was the only good thing maybe come out of it. You learned that, you know, everybody's the same.
You acted exactly as you would naturally in your environment at home, but you were not encouraged not to relate, were you?
No, they would rather keep it segregated. This way is one of the things they like. Certain shops were segregated. I mean, the silk screen shop I worked in was always pure white. That's mm-hmm. the way they kept it.
Thank you.
Spoke about you had preferential jobs, Mr. Jackson. Do you think you got those jobs because you were white?
I would say this had a lot to do with it.
You went to high school, didn't you?
Yes, sir. And usually I would go, you see the correction officer and you talk to him, and I was, you know, fortunate. I could relate to him. You know, they could, a lot of times when some of the downstaters from New York would talk, they couldn't catch on to what they call the hip talk or whatever, and so they could relate a little more to me, and this, I think, helped.
Were there any blacks in this kind of job?
There were, you know, what we call token blacks in certain jobs, yes, but that was about all.
Could you tell us a little more about this successful living course?
This was... given by the chaplains at the institution, and all they talked about was, if I remember right, was mainly on, you should come to church, and, maybe we can help you out, and things like this. The chaplain at the institution provides, like, birthday cards, greeting cards for the inmates. And he told us what, you know, he could do, get the cards for you, you know, if you had any troubled at home or something and you would like to discuss it, you could go talk with a chaplain. Or if you had trouble with your letter writing, you wasn't getting letters from home, he would write a letter home for you, you know.
He has initial interviews with you, too, doesn't he?
At the time I went there, I never received an initial interview.
And just one more. Do you fear from your appearance here today any kind of parole, reprisal?
Well, I mean, you know, I have some thoughts about this. I don't know, you know, I don't know what will happen. Sure. But I felt that it's got to come out eventually, and people have a right to know. We pay, I don't know, I believe it's something like $6,000 a year that the taxpayers paid to keep me incarcerated per year. They didn't get nothing for their money. It was a waste. Why don't they do something with the money?
Thank you.
I have one question in the area of parole, which seems to me to be one of the top priority issues to which we should all be directing our thoughts. I believe that you said that when you went before the parole board, there were three commissioners, three parole officers, three commissioners, and there were others in the room who were correctional officers who were there as guards.
Yes,
is that
ma'am.
Right? Were there any other people in the room at that time who were making these judgments? What is the makeup of those who make this decision what kind of a slip you're going to get?
Usually there's an institution parole officer and there's a stenographer also. And the first time that was the entire makeup. This last time Judge Fisher was there and several other persons whom I don't know. But the whole decision, as I understand it, is made by the three commissioners who are present. It doesn't require a vote on the entire board of 12, just the three who are there.
And then there's no one with whom you are living day by day who is really a part of the decision. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Thank you. That's all.
Mr. Jackson, let's pin down this issue of preferential treatment. Were there blacks in the Attica who had high school education like yourself?
Certainly.
Were they treated as well as you in terms of job assignments and that?
No. I mean, it was just one of those, there was certain jobs, the hospital was one where it was mostly white. There was very few blacks who worked in the hospital.
Were whites, in other words, what I'm trying to find out is that were whites who had, say, less education than some blacks, did they get better jobs?
They would stand, just the fact that they're being white is an asset, you know.
I see. Okay. I just wanted to be sure that I understood your testimony. That's all.
Mr. Jackson, were you ever physically abused by the correction officers?
No, sir, I was not.
Did you see any of that?
Yes, sir, I did.
Could you say something more about that?
I testified in federal court in October 4th. I was out shortly after the uprising was put down. I was on a cleanup detail, and at this time they were, to use the term, they were running what they call a gauntlet, two lines of officers and putting inmates in between them. I've seen two examples of this.
Yeah. Is that the only time
Yes, sir, that is.
Mr. Jackson, you mentioned disparity in sentencing in the courts. Do you feel is there a feeling among inmates that there's also disparity in sentences by the Adjustment Committee? In other words, if two different persons got involved in a fight, inmates predict who will receive a tough sentence and who won't, or is it arbitrary?
And the whole thing, it just depends on who you are, what your status is in the institution. The worst thing is to be black and militant. Now, it's a little better to be white and militant. You may get a little better play. And if you're white and a nice guy, then you'll even get a better play. This is how the sentencing goes. And it depends upon how the officer writes up the report on you. He makes his own report. Like, he'll say, I saw John Doe in his cell cooking with an illegal heating device. Now, he can spice this up a little bit, too, you know. And you have no right to see what he wrote. And when you go in there, you take what they give you.
You don't have a right to confront the officer?
No, sir.
Thank you.
I have
one more question on reflection, a kind of a summary question. I understand you to say, Mr. Jackson, that you were in a relatively favored position among the inmates in the institution because you were white, because you came from an essentially rural background and therefore could relate better to the correction officers, because it was your first offense, perhaps because it was a nonviolent offense, and because you played the game according to their rules, so that you really had no problems and perhaps were favored in various ways, except in one respect, on the parole. And there you got socked as hard as you could be socked.
Yes, sir.
You still have no reason for that, as you think it, arbitrary judgment.
Right. This is a bad thing. A man goes to the parole board, and when he comes back, he can go ask the parole officer, why did I get hit? He'll tell you. We don't have to tell you. They don't tell you why you get hit or what the criteria is to make parole. So a man is going in there and he's at odds with himself the whole time. He don't know whether he's going to make it or if he continues his behavior, if he's got good behavior, if it's going to do him any good, because he don't know. He has no idea on the whole situation. It's really bad.
Would you guess then that perhaps there was some unfavorable report from a correction officer that you didn't know about?
Very possible. Or many occasions, I think it goes right back to the original probation report. Now, a probation report was made up on me, and I was never allowed to see it. Anything that was written in there, I cannot rebut. I don't know what's in there, and I can, you know, take a guess. But this here is used as a predicate to sentence me, and then it's used as a predicate for the parole board to set my minimum. And this thing's working against me the whole time, and yet I can't, there could be some erroneous material. There's nothing I can do about it.
Yes, thank you. Were there any other questions from members of the commission?
Could I ask one more? You testified about some rather minor changes that were made since the events in September. You know, more toilet paper, free soap, one thing or another. Apart from those, is there any general or summary kind of description that you would make about what changed after those events at Attica?
Well, I would say since the insurrection, we've lost a lot of our recreation. This has not been remade. Lost the hobby permits. They made some minor concessions. I mean, I think this was mainly because the public was looking on. And then they made a thing on, they were going to change the censorship. And actually, they just changed things around. It's just as tough as it ever was. And they've made no real concessions whatsoever. And when I left 3 weeks ago, it was the same as it always was, only a little bit worse. And it just hasn't changed at all.
Had the Inmates Grievance Council been instituted before you left?
I voted the Friday before I left.
Do you think that will make a difference?
Hopefully it will. I think that this will develop a little more rapport between the inmates and the administration, whereas before there was none whatsoever.
Thank you very much, Mr. Jackson. You've been most helpful.
I'm waiting for the next witness. I wonder whether the camera can focus on the menu which we've put on the easel. There's a menu there for, I believe, August 15, 1971. Mr. Jackson previously described the supper menu, and I think it would be informative to take a look at a menu. This is before the riot. This is August 15, 1971. You can just, if you could just move, scan with the camera. You've shown breakfast. This is dinner, which is at the lunch hour. And then supper for radio. The supper is French onion soup, saltines, pineapple jam, bread, and tea. Pick out indiscriminately any day just to get an idea of what it looks like. This is Tuesday, which shows Rice Krispies for breakfast with milk and toast. Would you now scan toward the midday meal? Sliced corned beef, fried potatoes. Could you now move on to the night meal? It's a grilled cheeseburger. Now you're on Wednesday. Could you now scan across? We're at breakfast, midday meal. Now to dinner, which is, I can't read that easily here. Is that sliced macaroni? Sliced bologna.
Baked potatoes.
On Thursday, that's breakfast. Could you scan across, please? A Salisbury steak for midday meal and across for the night meal, please. What is that? I don't see that.
Hash, beef hash with onions, chili sauce,
beef hash. Now, the last, Friday, please. Breakfast, and now we just move to the midday meal. That's fish sticks, and then further, tuna and egg salad. Mr. Chairman, our next witness is Mr. Matthews, and Mr. Addison will question him.